regard to the testimony you provide to the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure today, in all subsequent committee communications concerning the hearing, you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Lamar McKay, and I'm president and chairman of VP America. We have obviously experienced a tragic series of events. Nearly 1 month ago, 11 people were lost in an explosion and fire aboard the Transocean Deepwater Horizon drilling rig, and 17 others were injured. The Gulf Coast communities are affected. Thousands of people are affected by this, and their livelihoods are being impacted. As a responsible party under the Oil Pollution Act, we will carry out our responsibilities to mitigate the environmental and economic impacts of this incident.
Welcome to VeracityRadio.com. Tonight, we take a look at the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico with Jason Leopold from TruthOut.org. We talked about the 60 Minutes segment, the Atlantis rig, and the Bush administration's willful failure to take action in BP's criminal violations. I also spoke with Doug Rivlin, press secretary for Luis Gutierrez's office, regarding the campaign to ban permanently the drilling leases for BP. We'll also have a reading of the letter he sent to Ken Salazar. Tonight's features with Jason Leopold regarding the comments and claims made by John Kiriakou in his recent interview for TruthOut.org. Kiriakou was famously known as the agent who was involved in the capture of Zayn al-Abidin Muhammad Hussein, the man commonly known as Abu Zubaydah. On September 6, 2006, George Bush proclaimed that Abu Zubaydah was a key figure in al-Qaeda, and in the subsequent years, he, Dick Cheney, Mark Thiessen, and others have used Zubaydah's alleged role as an excuse to torture suspected combatants against the United States. As you will hear, Zubaydah's role is not as portrayed, and the veracity of Kiriakou's claims have not withstood the test of time. In fact, much of Kiriakou's account in December 2007 was secondhand, presented almost as firsthand, and certainly relied upon as an authority on whether it was appropriate to torture a man for intelligence. We'll hear audio from Kiriakou, Jason Leopold's interview, and testimony of Ali Soufan. Thank you for tuning in. We'd love your feedback. You can send an email to veracityradio@gmail.com. First up, BP's catastrophe in the Gulf with Jason Leopold.
Mr. Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for missing part of the earlier part of the hearing. I'm very interested and concerned, as are citizens in my district, constituents all throughout the country, on this issue and what it's doing to the flora and the fauna of the Gulf region. The entire United States of America will be affected by this, but particularly the Gulf States regions, which border my city of Memphis. New Orleans is like a sister city, and we consider the Gulf Coast as part of our world. It's part of all of our worlds. We need to be concerned. So if I ask any questions that have been asked before, I apologize. First, I'd like to ask, I guess, Mr. McKay and Mr. Newman, if you know the answer, help me with it. This dome that you all came up with that you brought down after about three or four weeks, and failed. When did y'all come up with that concept?
That particular cofferdam, that particular one, it's been modified, was used in prior spills in shallow water.
So it was not a unique process. It was just at the depth it was.
The depth is different, and the issue with it in terms of why it didn't work on first try was that hydrates formed.
It froze, right. The water got in there. So why didn't you have some study done on what would, if that would have worked, or done some research to see that it would have worked, or precautions to have made that work at depths of 5,000 feet, since you have wells at that depth and many more deeper? What was done before to make sure that would work?
Well, of course, we don't know the specific fluid until the well's drilled, and we're still learning about the fluid. So that particular fluid is a very unique fluid in that it has very high gas, and it has a propensity for forming hydrates at that depth.
And when you say the fluid, you mean what's coming out of the earth right now and polluting the Gulf of Mexico?
Yes.
Why didn't you try something? I mean, couldn't you have used, you took that fluid out of the earth and you put it in your boats and you sold it. Couldn't you have used that fluid? Or maybe I'm wrong because I'm not a chemist, but couldn't you have used that to test it and find out if it worked?
Well, this particular well is the first well drilled on that structure ever. And what I'm really trying to say is the fluid's unique. The technology was used in shallow water. It's not been used offshore in 5,000 feet of water. It was difficult to predict what hydrate formation with that fluid at that depth.
There was no way to simulate it?
We did simulate. In fact, we said we're worried about hydrates.
And so you worried, but you didn't simulate it enough to know that there was a way to get around it. Let me ask you this. You've right now got a hose you've stuck in there, and it's siphoning off whatever, 1,000, 2,000, whatever. When did you come up with that concept?
Within the first couple of weeks in terms of an idea.
Why didn't you have this idea 2 years ago?
Well, we have a unique situation here. I don't think anybody could have predicted that we have a blowout preventer that didn't work, a lower marine riser package on top of it, 4,300 feet of riser that is damaged and trenched in the Gulf of Mexico. So what we had to devise was a system. We had to fabricate it and build it that can fit inside that pipe with drill pipe inside it and rubber diaphragms that can help keep the water out. That is an entirely unique situation with where this leak is happening.
Don't you think you should have envisioned the worst possible case scenario when you're dealing with an ecosystem that is unique and special and so important to the people, let alone the flora and the fauna? And shouldn't have you thought of the worst possible case scenario and prepared for it and had this type of technology on day one going down there? Why do you have to wait for a calamity to occur to come up with, oh, what should we do now?
Well, I don't think we've been doing that. We've been working parallel paths since the first moments this happened. First, to actuate the blowout preventer, if we could possibly do it. We worked for 10 days trying to do that. Parallel to that, and simultaneous.
Mr. McKay, understand this. I'm talking about a year ago. Why didn't you envision the worst possible case scenario that all this stuff would happen? And what do we do if there's a gap 5,000 feet down and this oil is just going out?
As I've said, we predicate that a blowout preventer is either going to work, can be manually intervened with if not, or can be approached if not. We've got a unique situation where we've had this thing on top of it that was supposed to release and it didn't. So therefore, we're having to engineer solutions that are in a very unique situation. Very unique situation. And I don't believe that could be predicted by anyone. Now, what I would say is we are learning a lot through this, and I think the subsea capability and the generic and some of the specific capability the industry needs to put in place and the regulators need to look at, I believe we'll learn through this, and I believe we're going to need to do some of that.
Can you assure me that the Atlantis rig that some thinks may be questionable and an expert engineer who, I don't know if he used to work for y'all or not, has questioned that it is secure and doesn't need some type of review?
The Atlantis is a production platform. There have been some allegations made that all the drawings weren't there. We did an internal study, and I understand, I haven't reviewed it in detail, but I understand all the drawings were there to safely start up and operate that platform, as well as meeting regulations. The MMS is looking into that. We've done an internal investigation, an ombudsman's investigation, and the MMS is going to look into it, which we welcome and will fully cooperate.
Senator Inhofe said that if we increase from $75 million to $10 billion, the liability of the major oil companies, that this would be a mistake because it would cause small oil companies not to be able to afford to do this type of work. And he was concerned about them. Are you also concerned about them and think it's a bad idea?
I've not had time, nor have we talked internally about policy and limits. What we've said is in this incident, for us, we're going to fulfill our responsibilities as a responsible party. We believe that means, in this case, waiving that $75 million and standing behind all legitimate claims that due to this that will impact the environment and the economy of the folks that are affected. So I can't comment on specific legislation or specific caps.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your attitude. You've advertised BP and you've come before Judiciary Committee and others at other times and talked about your green perspectives. I would hope you'd put more emphasis on your green work. It's obvious when we use 25% of the Earth's fossil fuels, and yet we only have capacity to have 2% of them here. There's no way we can use fossil fuels to serve our energy needs in the future and to do it safely. We need to look at wind and we need to look at solar. And we need to have BP be a leader in emphasizing that and moving on where you won't have these type of catastrophes. You won't have these type of issues. And God forbid something like this happens in the Arctic. I want to see your hose and I want to see your dome. It ain't going to work up there. And they're not going to be able to do things to preserve that environment. You've already ruined the Gulf. I don't want you to see you ruin the rest of the world's oceans. Come up with the worst possible case scenario and figure out a way to do it. And if you got to put a man in a tube and stick him down there or a polar bear and teach him how to do it, you ought to do it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, we're joined here with Jason Leopold. I want to thank you for being here today. How are you, Jason?
Great. Thanks for having me back, Chris.
You're very welcome. So we've had a very busy week with BP. First off, let's start with the Atlantis rig and what we know about the Atlantis rig and the article on 60 Minutes this weekend.
Right. Well, the Atlantis rig, the latest on that is the members of Congress, more than 20 members of Congress, have written a letter to Ken Salazar, I believe, and basically have asked him to shut it down, which is a pretty major, is a major development, obviously. Atlantis is a the deepest drilling platform in the world, if I'm not mistaken, and it's 7,000 feet. But it's the deepest drilling platform that currently is operating in the Gulf. And you know, as I first reported, gave the first in-depth look at what was happening with Atlantis. You know, I spoke to a whistleblower who a year ago made the claims that before Deepwater Horizon disaster, he had actually made claims that, look, you know, this is a drilling platform in the Gulf that is operating without the required engineering documents. And if it continues, we may see a catastrophe. At the time, he said, you know, far bigger than Exxon Valdez, the 1989 disaster that happened in Alaska. You know, I did this very in-depth story about a month ago, and just highlighting many of the claims that he had been making, using documents to you know, support those claims. In fact, there were even some BP internal documents that said, "Yeah, we do not have up-to-date, you know, engineering or design documents for this project." And that could be disastrous. What happened after that story ran, 60 Minutes took notice of it. They were planning a very big special report on Deepwater Horizon, and they were going to also discuss this. And it aired this past Sunday, and they spoke to the whistleblower. His name is Ken Abbott. He made his debut on 60 Minutes. And, you know, as a result of drawing attention to this, Congress is now saying you need to shut it down, speaking obviously to the Minerals Management Service that licenses it and regulates offshore drilling, that it could prove to be a far bigger disaster if anything were to happen there than Deepwater Horizon. I'm not quite sure what's involved in, you know, shutting down a rig like that, a drilling rig that's already been operating for nearly 3 years. I don't know what's involved, but I think that it's clear that there needs to be some serious investigation into the whistleblower's claims, into Ken Abbott's claims. And, you know, I may have mentioned this before when we spoke, but the Minerals Management Service, as we know, you know, they've literally been in bed with the oil industry officials. We know that from a, you know, Inspector General's report that came out, you know, a few years ago that showed that regulators at Minerals Management had, you know, been partying with the people and companies that they were supposed to, you know, regulate, that they were sleeping with officials from oil companies, that they were sharing drugs with them. This was a relationship that, you know, our government had with the companies they were supposed to regulate that, you know, were literally way too cozy. In addition to to the letter, Ken Salazar yesterday did say that he was going to pretty much shake up minerals management and break it up, if I'm not mistaken.
There's two kind of themes emanating from the oil industry, as mainly through the CEOs, I guess, at this point. But one is that the regulators didn't do their job. Now, to me, that always seems like the argument that a cop is responsible if a robber breaks into a store. Certainly, we want the cops doing their job, but that doesn't suddenly right. alleviate the criminality of the person who just perpetrated a crime.
Right, exactly. And I think that you know, you bring up a good point, and it's twofold here. I mean, first of all, BP has a track record. I mean, they have a rap sheet. They have a long history of you know, skirting safety, maintenance issues. They have instituted massive cost-cutting measures throughout their entire operations, not just in the Gulf, but in Alaska, at their Prudhoe Bay facility, at their refineries throughout the country. I mean, this is a company that already has, you know, several felony convictions, misdemeanors, they're on probation, they've paid hundreds of millions of dollars in fines. And so I think that they have an incredibly powerful lobbying effort to begin with. At the same time, we have, you know, regulators that have not been, and I think that this is, you know, has been demonstrated in testimony and documents, that really have not done a complete and thorough job enforcing regulations that need to be followed. You know, there's, yes, it's sort of the, you know, scenario or you know, the example I would give is that, you know, you leave the car running with the keys in it and the door is unlocked, and therefore, you know, they stole the car. That doesn't mean that, you know, it makes it legal to steal the car, you know. So I think the fact that they had these restrictions, or the fact that the Minerals Management Services, you know, perhaps left some loopholes, I think BP, you know, pushed it further and clearly, you know, in this case, you know, stole the car despite the fact that it was running.
Did you catch the Stephen Newman comment that I sent yesterday with the where he had responded to this article, and specifically where he responded to their own internal investigation for safety reports?
Right, and I think that's what's so so laughable is that, you know, we can't trust BP to do their own internal investigation. I think that, you know, just going over various documents over the past decade, you know, particularly dealing with issues revolving around the Texas refinery disaster, but focusing even more on the problems and oil spill up in Prudhoe Bay and the North Slope in Alaska, you know, BP has done their own internal investigations. And the fact is that, you know, they've done it with the intent of giving themselves a clean bill of health. However, in other independent investigations have showed that BP instituted massive cost-cutting measures that came at the expense of safety and maintenance and actually left their facilities and employees vulnerable, you know, to disaster. You know, in Texas, following the refinery explosion, they still did not implement, you know, the safety measures that they promised, and employees still have, you know, have died because of various things that happened at the refineries that should have been prevented. Trusting a company like BP, you know, to do a thorough, independent, and complete investigation is ludicrous, frankly. I can't imagine that anyone would even support such a statement, but would even support the results of such an investigation.
Yeah, well, we have seen in the past at least one person who wanted to pursue a criminal probe into BP. Tell us about the story of Scott West.
Yeah, and this is pretty fascinating. I mean, Scott West was the special agent in charge at the Environmental Protection Association Criminal Investigation Division. And, you know, a small shop that basically, you know, investigated environmental crimes that were committed, you know, throughout country in various by various individuals and even companies. And back in 2005, Scott West was transferred to EPA's Seattle offices. And while he was there, he had been told that he needed to meet a guy named Chuck Hamel. And Chuck Hamel had been this oil industry watchdog, you know, somebody who I like to describe as the protector of whistleblowers from BP. And for years, Chuck Hamel had been writing letters to BP executives, including then, you know, President Lord John Brown in London, on behalf of these whistleblowers who worked at BP's Prudhoe Bay facility, who said, you know, this company and this operation in the North Slope is a disaster waiting to happen. They have cut back on safety, on maintenance. They have, we have severe staff shortages. And in this time when Chuck Hamel had been making these statements, you know, Congress was debating opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to exploration. And because BP was already operating up in the North Slope, they stood the, you know, they were the likely candidate to lead the drilling effort. So Scott West was told that he needed to meet this guy named Chuck Hamel. And they met. Chuck Hamel had told him that there is going to be a pipeline rupture in Alaska at the Prudhoe Bay, by the Prudhoe Bay facility in short order. And that when it would happen, it would be catastrophic. And Scott West said, you know, obviously he was intrigued. You know, I like to describe Scott West as he's like a street cop. He even has the demeanor of a street cop who would be investigating, you know, a murder or a robbery. I mean, he very much approaches these incidents or even leads and tips as if it were, you know, a real crime. And in fact, it is. So he was told that that this pipeline was, you know, corroded, that there was quite a bit of sludge in the pipeline, that BP hadn't made any effort to perform maintenance or to clean it. And Scott asked Chuck Hamel, well, you know, how do you know this? And he said that I got this from the whistleblowers that I've been working with over the years. And he was told that, or I should say that Scott West, the EPA investigator, told Chuck Hamel, said, look, you know, unless you have firsthand knowledge or you can put me in touch with these people, I can't do anything about it. He put them in touch. Chuck Hamel put Scott West in touch with the whistleblowers. And Scott West was told in no uncertain terms that this pipeline near a caribou crossing was going to rupture. In fact, he was told that, you know, new employees were advised that when they're working in that area, not to even let their keys bang against the pipeline because it was so fragile that they were afraid it would bust a hole in it. He got their statements. He reported some of this to his colleagues. And, you know, some months go by, and sure enough, in March 2006, early March, he gets a phone call. And it's from one of the whistleblowers that he had been speaking with. And he said, just as I told you, there's a pipeline leak.
And that would be March 2nd, 2006 for the audience.
Yes. And the whistleblower said, and it's pretty bad. And what happened was is that there was a pencil eraser-sized hole that was in the pipeline that opened up due to severe corrosion, and it leaked oil. And what's fascinating and devastating at the same time is that oil had been leaking for 5 days without anyone even noticing it. And the leak detection equipment was malfunctioning. And part of the problem there, and by the way, I should add that these employees had consistently told BP management about these problems, and BP management ignored them. And there, it's clear that that is documented, and I believe BP had admitted as much. You know, there's the pipeline rupture. There's started leaking, and it turned out that it went on for 5 days before anyone noticed it. And the only way it was noticed is that, you know, an employee had been driving around surveying the area and smelled petroleum in the air. He got out. It was you know, it was across the tundra, which was frozen. And as he stepped out of his car, you know, he got a black foot from just stepping in this, you know, in this oil. And in the end, it turned out there were about 267,000 gallons of oil that leaked, making it the second biggest, you know, disaster up there since Exxon Valdez. It forced BP to shut down its processing centers. This was a time of tight supplies. And, you know, what happened from there is gasoline prices spiked. So Scott launched an investigation, you know, continued to speak to whistleblowers. And he built a pretty strong case in the 17 months that he spent investigating this. With the help of, you know, federal prosecutors, they convened the grand jury. They subpoenaed documents. And Scott was looking at this and approaching this as a serious environmental crime. And he was going after not only the company, but senior company officials at BP who knew about this and did nothing about it. And he was pursuing, you know, felony charges here. And so were the prosecutors and the FBI that were working alongside him. So he got to the point where, you know, they started getting the documents and the testimony. And by June of 2007, you know, just about a little over a year in his investigation, one of the assistant U.S. attorneys in Alaska who was working on this case sent out an email to other prosecutors and investigators, basically summing up where they were. You know, they were getting ready for a meeting in August of 2007 in Anchorage to more or less present, you know, and more or less update, you know, the Justice Department or the U.S. Attorney's Office on where they were. And at this point in this email, the assistant U.S. attorney in Alaska said, yeah, they've got a pretty strong case. They were able to demonstrate, you know, that perhaps felony charges would be looming for BP, but that's what they would be pursuing. And so what happened was in August of 2007, Scott Weston met with federal prosecutors in Anchorage. And at this meeting, he was asked, what do we have right now to charge BP with? And he said, well, if we went to trial right now, what could we charge them with? And he said, well, if we went right now, the only thing we can, you know, charge them with is a, you know, criminal misdemeanor for, you know, Clean Water Act violations. You know, he was asked, do we have any evidence? Do we have anything to support the, you know, felony charges against individuals or against the company? And he said, no. And so at that point, he was told by the Justice Department prosecutors, well, we don't want to pursue this any further. We're going to settle with BP. We're going to settle with the misdemeanor, and we'll just fine them, you know, for these violations. And Scott was just livid. He, you know, had invested thousands of hours. And like I said, this is a career, you know, criminal investigator. He spent two decades at the EPA. He told me that he'd never seen something like this happen. And he was pulled aside at the end of the meeting by one of the U.S. attorneys, Karen Loeffler, who is now she is now the U.S. attorney in Alaska. She told him that Ronald Tempest, who was the head of the Justice Department's Environmental and Natural Resources Division, that he had instructed her and her team to settle with BP for this criminal misdemeanor. So there was, you know, as far as Scott was concerned, there was clear-cut intervention by, you know, Bush administration appointees to dismantle this probe. He said to me that, you know, he even asked, I need at least another year. And he was told no. He said, how about give me six more months to, you know, continue the investigations? No. 3 more months? No. He said he still had plenty of documents that he needed to go through. And what happened is that, you know, during this time, it appears that BP had been negotiating secretly without, you know, during the course of this investigation, negotiating with the Justice Department, it appears to be Maine Justice, to settle all of their criminal investigations, all of the alleged crimes that they had been accused of relating to a price-fixing scheme involving, propane, manipulating the propane market, the refinery explosion, and the oil spill in Alaska. In fact, it's funny, after the March 2006 oil spill, about 5 months later in August, there was another, oil spill due to the same reason. It looked like the Justice Department just basically wanted to, settle all of this. They consolidated all the cases together, and BP pleaded guilty to a criminal misdemeanor for Alaska, paid a $20 million fine. They pleaded guilty to a felony for the refinery explosion, paid a $50 million fine, and entered into a deferred prosecution agreement with the Justice Department where they admitted that they manipulated the propane market. So this was a package deal, and Scott had, like I said, he said that this never, ever happened to him before. Never in his career had he, seen this sort of intervention or was told that you could no longer, pursue the case. And he had, as I said, had BP executives in his crosshairs. So he was absolutely going after these folks, and he collected evidence that, in fact, they knew about this corrosion. They didn't do anything about it. It was negligible, and that's a crime. After this was settled, what happened was, or I should say prior, just to backtrack a bit, so his department or his office had come up with an analysis on what they could fine BP, what kind of penalties they would have to pay, or the amounts of penalties, a dollar figure. And there were, a wide range of figures that came out, but they felt that on the high end, they could penalize them about $672 million. And on the low end, about $58 million. And during the plea discussions and the settlement talks that took place in October of 2007, the U.S. attorney in Alaska at the time, Nelson Cohen, opened up with the lowest figure that the Justice Department could find BP.
This opposite, just not to get too far off of, isn't this opposite of what prosecutors normally do? Don't they usually go for the high end?
Absolutely. That's what was so stunning to Scott, is that, the Justice Department, in fact, they came up with their own range. They said, about $20 to $35 million, and let's keep this in perspective. BP earned their net profits in 2007 were a little more than $17 billion.
Exactly.
So $20 to $35 million, for what Scott said was a serious environmental crime and disaster that happened in Alaska was paltry. So they came up with their own figure, $20 to $35 million. And what happened was they opened with the lowest figure, $20 million. They didn't even bother to go, above that. Scott was saying that the benchmark that was used was the Olympic pipeline explosion in 1999 in Bellingham, Washington, which is what they set the bar at. And again, Scott felt that was even, a very, very low figure. And then he said he was told that, this amount was agreed upon because, it's a Texas refinery explosion. They wound up paying a $50 million fine, and people died there. And by the way, the person who was involved with the investigation into that disaster also was disgusted, to quote Scott, that there would be a settlement of such a low figure for a disaster that ended up killing 15 people. BP did settle with the families, but the independent reports and investigations that came out after the fact showed that this was this could have been the refinery explosion could have been prevented, but BP failed to take action. So, you know, Scott was basically saying he felt that this was already agreed upon, that this was basically a show for him because he had been very vocal about his, you know, what he felt was a crime in and of itself, that they were, you know, settling, you know, with the company and not allowing the investigation to proceed. So they, after this was done, they tried to get rid of him. They tried to fire him. He remained on board, you know, for about another year. And in October 29th, 2008, he retired. 2 days later, he blew the whistle. He became a whistleblower in his own right, and exposed the entire backstory, if you will, as to, you know, what happened here. And, you know, at the time, it wasn't really something that made headlines. It wasn't really a, you know, it was what I would refer to as an explosive story, but it didn't get that much attention because, you know, nobody was really paying close attention to it. You know, keep in mind that this took place right around the election, very close to the election,
right.
And people were paying, you know, were focusing heavily on that. So, you know, he aligned himself with a nonprofit who took on his case. They tried to press the Justice Department's Inspector General to investigate. They felt that this was improper, again, they were rebuffed. And, you know, so right now he felt that this would be a perfect, I sought him out, and because it, frankly, you know, what he had to say at the time, regarding BP, and some of the questions he raised are some of the same questions that are being raised now. And, he felt that it was, you know, a perfect time to, raise a bit of awareness into the, you know, to focus more on the culture of BP, and as a way of explaining how the Deepwater Horizon disaster happened, and because we do know that there, you know, there are questions about safety, preventative measures that you know, BP said were in place that appear not to have been in place, and you know, he wanted to tell his story. And obviously he, you know, like I said, as somebody who spent 2 decades there, and had been, you know, leading the investigation into this company, I think that comes with quite a bit of credibility. Ironically, in November of 2009, again, in Prudhoe Bay, there was a pipeline rupture and about 46,000 gallons of crude had spilled out of this pipeline, and it burst as a result of ice buildup, air, you know, pressure from ice buildup, you know, burst the pipeline. There's now an investigation that's taking place in Alaska, being led by the EPA and the FBI again. Sort of, you know, for Scott, this is like deja vu, even though he does not work at the agency anymore. But they're investigating yet again BP in Alaska, you know, to see if in fact there was perhaps any issues resulting from maintenance upgrades that BP had not been taking on after they pled guilty. Now, keep in mind that BP is right now on probation. BP, you know, Exploration Alaska, on probation for, you know, the March 2006 spill.
I think we need to call their probation officer.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I did speak to the probation officer.
Yeah.
It's very funny. Her name is Mary Frances Barnes. She's been BP's probation officer for about 10 years. That's how long, you know, that is the time that, you know, BP has been on probation numerous times for a wide range of violation. She's actually been, you know, she's very familiar with the company. And I asked her, I said, look, you know, is this a violation, you know, of their probation? You know, the fact that this pipeline burst, if it did show that they were, you know, negligent. And she said that's something that the investigators would be looking into to determine if they violated the terms of their probation. So it remains to be seen. That's an active investigation right now. You know, something that's not getting much attention, largely due to what's happening in the Gulf. But it's sure. one area where we actually may see, you know, some activity where we may see a, you know, BP being charged for probation violations. Perhaps, you know, the case could be reopened. And, you know, Scott's out there and he's trying to, you know, again, raise awareness about the fact that it's not just the Gulf. And I think that people are keenly aware that it isn't just, you know, the Gulf, that this is, you know, widespread. And, you know, last year, BP was slapped with an between $85 and $87 million fine from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration because it did not implement the safety measures at its Texas refinery operation that it had promised to. In fact, OSHA found that BP was had willfully violated over 400 provisions that were supposed to be implemented. Basically, they knowingly ignored, you know, the demands to upgrade.
Where is Scott West working now?
Scott West works for Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. He's the head of their investigation and, you know, based in Seattle. And he is, you know, he's speaking out about this and, you know, is hoping that perhaps, you know, maybe members of Congress will take a second look at it. They seem to have been somewhat interested, you know, a few years ago, but the interest waned as time progressed.
I want to thank Jason Leopold from truthout.org. Check out his latest article at Truthout. And make sure that you also support the site.